Let's look 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Since we only have 13 verses, I think we'll just deal with all 13. This is the love chapter, is what they call it, often referred to because it deals with love, and it is the subject of the chapter. And I find it rather interesting. The book of 1 Corinthians deals with a group of people who are not functioning as a church properly. And as a matter of fact, they're misusing gifts. They're not partaking of the Lord's Supper properly. They are tolerating sin in their midst. And however, we find that many of the charismatic churches look to 1 Corinthians for support for everything that they authorize. This is not the kind of book that you look for and take one verse out and say, there, that settles it. Oftentimes, Paul is using the negative example. He is referring to them in bad light. And in chapter 12, that's what he did. He dealt with spiritual gifts. Now, I'm not a big fan of taking a test to find out what your spiritual gift is. If you can't figure it out and other people around you can't see it, you need to keep refining because you haven't manifested it yet. So he deals with spiritual gifts. And then as he closes verse 12, he really lays the groundwork for chapter 13. So before we look at chapter 13, let's look at verse 31 of chapter 12. He says, but covet earnestly the best gifts, and yet show I unto you a more excellent way. What Paul is saying here, after talking about tongues, after talking about prophecy, after talking about all of these spiritual gifts that are mentioned there, after all of the things that he deals with, that these people are jealous of this guy's gift or this person's trying to do this, you have people getting up speaking in tongues. And by the way, tongues in the New Testament refers to known languages. It doesn't refer to jibber jabber. If it said jibber jabber, God has a way with words. He can say what he wants to say. He could say they got up and said Yamaha, Suzuki, Kawasaki over and over and over. But he didn't say that. He said they spoke in unknown tongues, languages that you and I wouldn't understand. And so someone knows German. Hey, I want to speak in German today in the service. Well, that's great, honey. None of us speak in German. So the problem here is Paul is chastising them for wanting to exercise these spiritual gifts. And he says, you're lacking the greatest gift. The greatest gift is not available to some, whereas prophecy would be available to some, or tongues would be available to some, or teaching or administration. These would not apply to everyone. But in chapter 13, he refers to the greatest gift. And here's the good news. The greatest gift applies to everyone. It is within us. So that's love. Now, I've broken down chapter 13 into three categories. And rather than reading all 13 verses, backing up, starting over, let's deal with these just in categories. Let's deal first of all with the first three verses. Let's deal with the excellency of love. Paul, keep in mind, is talking about these people misusing gifts and showing off and mistreating their fellow man. So he says, let me show you how great love is, how superior it is, the excellency of love. It says in verse 1 through 3, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, and have not charity, I am become as a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, and have not charity, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Now, charity is another word for love, and a more accurate translation of this Greek word would be love. When we say charity, people think about this. They think about giving to a charitable cause. Well, we know this is not referring to giving to a charitable cause, because Paul said, if I give my goods to feed the poor and my body to be burned and I still don't have charity, I would say, wait a minute, bud, that was charity. You gave everything you had. So the emphasis here is not alms or gifts to help someone. The emphasis here is love, love for someone else. You can do all of these things, but without love, they're nothing. Let's go back and deal first of all with speech in verse 1. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I have become as a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Paul is not saying that he speaks this way. Paul is saying, if I did, though as I, or though I speak. He's not saying that I'm doing it or that I have done it. He's saying, if I did do it. Because Paul did not have all prophecy. He didn't have all knowledge. As a matter of fact, he says later on in the chapter, right now we do not prophesy fully, correctly, because we don't know. So Paul's not, I've heard people say, well, Paul spoke to angels in angel language. No. He said, even if I did speak in the tongues of men. Now, Paul probably did speak in tongues, because Paul probably knew multiple languages. And proof of that is he knew Hebrew and he knew Greek. Therefore, Paul had a gift of tongues, if you will. There is a supernatural gift of tongues, and that was used on the day of Pentecost, so to speak, where the apostles were filled with the Holy Ghost and they spoke. But here's the supernatural part. Everyone heard them in their own language and dialect. So if you heard me preaching on the day of Pentecost, and you were from Arkansas, you heard me just like this. But if you were from England, you heard me preach with an English accent. And if you were from Mexico, you heard me preach in Spanish. And if you were from southern Mexico, you heard me preach in Spanish with an Ecuadorian accent. Now go manufacture that in a modern day charismatic service. Speech here, he says, if I speak in tongues, and he takes it beyond just speaking in tongues, because that's what they wanted to do. He said, let's say I spoke in the tongues of angels. Now, there's a Jewish tradition that angels had their own language. And some of the old Jewish rabbis speculated on what the language of the angels would be. And Paul here is making it clear that it doesn't matter how gifted of a speaker you are. It doesn't matter how many languages you know. It doesn't matter how spiritual you are. He says, if I have not charity, I have not love, I am become but a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Now, I've heard some musicians make a guitar talk, but I've never heard anybody make words out of a cymbal, have you? Have you ever heard someone make words out of a tambourine? No. It's just tink, 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 tink. There's no knowledge there. He said to have proper language. But to do it without love is unprofitable. It's useless. It has no conveyance of information because it's not conveyed with love. So the excellency of love is superior to words. If you just tell someone you love them, but you never express that love, then you're really just lying, and there's no truth in it. Look at verse 2. The excellency of love is superior to skill. Notice what Paul says in verse 2. Though I have the gift of prophecy, and understand all mysteries, and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains, have not charity, I'm nothing. Now, prophecy here could refer to one of two things. Both would fit. Prophecy in that he is foretelling future events. He's predicting the future. Or it could mean prophecy in forthtelling. He is preaching. Both of those would be in view here. Whether you take it as he is foretelling future events or foretelling biblical facts, both of these things, he says, if I have this gift and I'm a preacher and I'm preaching, if I have this gift and I'm telling people what's coming in the future, he says, if I have these and, notice this, and I understand all mysteries. Now this is referring to prophecy. If I understand what God is going to do in the future, this is referring to the present. If I understand fully how God operates today, you and I are going to have a hard time understanding the future because we can't fully understand God now. Any of you understand the Trinity fully and want to articulate it clearly? Well, no, there's a lot of things in the Trinity that we accept by faith because we cannot reason with them. We cannot understand them. Paul said, if I had the gift of prophecy and was a great preacher and I understood all mysteries and I could do like those end times gurus and get up with a wall chart that went from one side of the sanctuary to the other and tell you exactly day for day how the 7 years of tribulation would work out and could tell you what all the horns on the beast meant right down to the toenail of the smallest dragon. Paul said, if I had all of that, and notice, he's still going, and all knowledge. Paul said, if I knew everything. Now, none of us know everything. When you start thinking you know a lot, you're revealing you don't know anything. Okay? Paul said, if I had all of this. Then he goes a step further. Not only would I have all knowledge and be a great orator and be a great preacher and be able to entertain great crowds, he takes it a step further. And though I have all faith, I had as much faith as any human could possibly have. So much faith that I could remove mountains. You remember the parable of Christ? You have as much faith as a grain of mustard seed, the smallest of all seeds. You could say to this mountain, be plucked up and cast into the sea, and it'd be so. Paul said, if I had that much faith on top of this great knowledge, on top of understanding prophecy, on top of being able to articulate it all clearly where everyone could understand it. Now, there ain't a preacher alive that wouldn't like to have that ability. Yeah, they do. He said, and I have not charity, I'm nothing. Love is superior to the most gifted preachers. Love is superior to the most gifted theologians. Love is superior to the most faithful of people. Paul says, the excellency of love is superior to everything you Corinthians want. Y'all want to get up and speak in tongues. Y'all want to get up and prophesy. Y'all want to get up and explain the Old Testament. Y'all want to get up and tell us about your faith. You want all of these things and you want to imitate this guy or that guy. You remember earlier in the book where he said, I am of Apollos, I'm of Cephas, I'm of this guy, I'm of Christ. He said, you all are imitating people, but you don't have love, therefore you are nothing. That brings us to verse 3. Verse 3 deals with sacrifice. The excellency of love is better than sacrifice. Now, Samuel is famous for saying to obey is better than sacrifice when God commanded the destruction of everything in the kingdom and King Saul decided to keep the best of the rams and the bulls and the sheep back for sacrifice to please God. And Samuel said to obey is better than sacrifice. Paul takes it a step further and says, love is superior to sacrifice. Verse 3, and though I bestow all of my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Paul begins by saying something that Christ commanded a young rich man to do. Go and sell all your goods and follow me. You'll have eternal life. The reason that this is not a command for everyone to sell what they have in order to gain everlasting life, it was Christ demonstrating to the self-righteous man that he didn't have what it took for salvation. Here, Paul says, if I were that guy, though I went out and sold everything I had and had nothing but the clothes on me and gave all that money to the poor to feed them. That's pretty impressive, isn't it? Paul takes it a step further. Though I give my body to be burned. Now, what in the world does that mean? Who wants to burn Paul's body? How's that helping poor people? I tell you, if we just had Paul and could torch him, we'd all be better off. It doesn't make sense, does it? Paul is really emphasizing here, and it's lost in translation because it's an obscure Greek word. He's emphasizing, though my body burned to glorify everything, to go above and beyond, to be of the utmost zeal, to be so zealous that everyone would recognize how great and how what a burning passion I had to do good. And you can go out and do all the good works in the world. And though everyone said, man, that person is just a charitable case. I mean, they are a model person. Paul says, though I were that person and I had not love, what? It didn't profit me one bit. It profiteth me nothing. Paul said, you can go out and give your life to the poor. You can go out and give stuff away. You can live as a pauper. And if you don't have love, you will be of no benefit. I often think of this verse when I think of the monks who live in monasteries, who live a life of simplicity, who give away their earnings to the poor, who live, basically on bread and water, and they think they're doing this as some kind of service to the world. If they don't have the love of God in them, it does them no good. That is essentially what Paul said, where he said, all of my good works are as filthy rags, as rubbish. It wasn't accomplished through love. They were accomplished through a burning zeal and a zealous spirit to demonstrate what I could do. Love is superior to speech, to skill, and to sacrifice. Now, Paul deals with the explanation of love. Everybody has this idea of what love is. Matter of fact, there was an old rock song, you remember it? I want to know what love is. That was the title of it. I think they said it about 20 times in the song. And I don't think they ever really figured it out according to the song. So what is love? What does it look like? Somebody said love is a lizard that lives in your gizzard. I think they just found words that rhyme together and strung them out on love. So what is an explanation? What does love look like? Is it puppy dog love? I mean, my daughter has puppy dog love. She loves little kittens. She loves puppies. She sees them. She falls in love with them. She wants to bring them home. Mom and dad raise them. What happened? Did the new wear off? Yes. Well, let's look at real love. Let's look at what real love is. And real love is found in verses 4 through 7. An explanation of love. Let's read it. Verse 4. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself. It is not puffed up. Doeth not behave itself unseemly. Seeketh not her own, nor is easily provoked. Thinketh no evil. Rejoiceth not in iniquity. But rejoiceth in truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Wow. Let's understand what's being said in these four verses, verses 4 through 7, an explanation of love. Let's look at each descriptor. The first thing we need to notice is that love is selfless. Love is selfless. Verse 4 through the middle part of verse 5 says, charity suffereth long. To suffereth long means to endure. To suffereth long means to be patient. It means to have a long fuse, if you will. It means that you don't blow up. You're not a ticking time bomb. To enduredly love someone means that you're patient with them. Think about it this way. We're patient with our children, watching them learn to do things. When your child learns to ride a bike, you don't go out there and push them one time and go, well, you didn't get it. You'll never ride a bike, kid. No. You stand them up. You dust them off. You tell them to quit crying. You put them back on it. You push them again. You stand them up. You keep doing this. Why? Because you're patient with who you're dealing with. That's what it means to suffereth long. It means to be slow and to be consistent and to endure. And he says, and it is kind. To be kind. Well, that's pretty self-explanatory, isn't it? Love is gentle. Love is pleasing. Love is something that is not harsh in any way. Charity envieth not. Now, love does not envy. What does it mean to envy? It means you want what someone else has. What was the problem at Corinth? They all were envying the other person. Everybody wanted somebody else's gift. Paul says, the reason I know that you don't love is because you're jealous of what someone else has. Envy is the ruiner of love. Tell you what, Hollywood is full of envy. Hollywood is devoid of love. It's evident in this one thing. They're all envious of the other person. Envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself. If you're not envious of something else and desiring something else, you don't go around showing off what you already have. Some people don't want anything else because look at what I've already got. Love is neither of those things. It's not going around flaunting itself. It's not going around showing off. Love is not a show off. Love is not envious of other things. Love's not puffed up. Pride and love don't go together. If you're puffed up, it means you're full of yourself. What did we say in this point about love? The sub-point about love? It's selfless. Love ain't about you. I wonder why... I don't wonder much anymore. I used to wonder why the divorce rate was so high in our time. After I met with a few young couples, I figured it out real quick. Both of them are absorbed in themselves, and neither one can turn off of himself long enough to love his spouse. They all want what they want. And if you follow that back, it's because they had a mom and dad that always gave them what they want, and they've never learned to give anything to anybody else. What do you call that? You call it spoiled brats. We are a narcissistic society where everybody is consumed with how they look and they want other people's stuff and they want to show off what they have, and love is devoid in our society. Hence, it's becoming vastly accepted for two men to get married. Well, duh, we don't know what love is. We don't understand the concept. This guy makes you happy and you make this guy happy. Oh, y'all ought to get married. Happiness is not love. Happiness is not mentioned in the list of love. It's not puffed up. It doeth not behave itself unseemly. Let's give this a modern translation. It's not rude. It's not rough. It's not obnoxious. Love is proper. Love is fitting. Love is not rash and quick. Love, lastly, under the selflessness of love, love seeketh not her own. The measure of love is in its desire to serve someone else. The wedding vows symbolize this perfectly. For richer, for poorer, for better or worse, sickness and health, till death do you part. What are they saying there? even if you're not getting what you want, even if you're not, even if things aren't going right, it's not about you. You're committing your love to this person. You're committing your care to this person to have and to hold, to treasure from this day forward. You are committing yourself to the care for someone else. And that person likewise is committing themselves to your care. That's what love is, because it's selfless. You don't figure into the equation. Your wants, your desires don't figure into the equation of love. Because true love is based not on you, but on whom you love. Hence the saying, love is blind. Don't you see this? No. They don't see it. They're not going to see it because they love that person. Let's look at the next thought. Love is selfless. Love is sincere. The middle part of verse 5 says, not easily provoked. Now, have you ever had someone come to you and say they're sorry, and you say, that's okay, I forgive you. And you turn right around, 10 seconds later, they're doing it again. Sorry. Like, okay, I forgive you. And they turn right around, and they do it again. Pretty soon, you know what you ask yourself? Are they really sorry? You say, well, no, they're not really sorry. Oh, what makes you think that? Because as soon as they say they're sorry, they turn right around and do it again. They're easily provoked. They're quick to do ill will. They're quick to go back to who they were. So many people claim to love someone else. And it lasts about 2 weeks. That ain't love. People say, we don't love each other anymore. I got a feeling you didn't love each other in the first place. It's not easily provoked. When someone genuinely loves someone else, it lasts longer. It takes longer. I've heard people say, we were having a great marriage up until 2 weeks ago. Listen, bud, there's going to be bumps in your marriage that don't last 2 weeks. There are going to be bumps in your marriage that last a year. Your spouse is going to fall off the deep end and be gone out in la-la land for maybe 6 months to 2 years. And if you truly love her or you truly love him, you're going to endure that time and believe they're going to come out of it because you love them. Well, I've had a bad summer with my spouse. No. No, true love is not easily provoked. True love, think of this, thinketh no evil. True love doesn't wish evil on someone. True love doesn't hope for evil on someone. True love doesn't rejoice in evil towards someone. If you love someone, you can't go, boy, I'm glad they got what they deserve. If you love someone, you can't rejoice when they suffer. True love thinketh no evil. If you claim to love someone and you rejoice when they suffer, then you do not truly love them. Verse 6, rejoiceth not in iniquity. You're not happy when bad things are done. True love is not something where we revel in someone else's misery. We don't rejoice when bad things happen to someone else. To rejoice not in iniquity also means we don't rejoice when sin is committed. Think about it this way. We shouldn't rejoice and laugh when someone does something sinful. Not if we truly love them. If we truly love them, their sinful condition should sadden us, not make us happy. True love, charity, the explanation of it, the latter part of verse 6, but rejoiceth in the truth. Now let's think about this for a moment. Since we don't laugh and rejoice when someone sins, since we don't laugh and rejoice when something bad happens to someone, yet we do rejoice when the truth is presented. Now why is this important? Well, if you do not rejoice over the truth, then you're turning a blind eye to the truth. It's like going to the doctor and having cancer, and the doctor comes out and says, well, I'm not going to tell that person the truth. Walks in there and says, hey, you'll be fine. There's nothing in the world wrong with you. What do you want, that guy? Or do you want the doctor that comes out and says, you're dying. You don't have much time. Here's your options for treatment. You need to be in serious consideration about how you're going to spend your last days. If that doctor takes his position seriously, if that doctor takes his obligation to you seriously and genuinely loves his patient, what's he going to do? Lie to them or tell them the truth? If you love them, you're going to love the truth. You're going to long for the truth to be told, and you're going to look to tell the truth yourself. And you're not going to rejoice at falsehood. If you truly love sinners, you're not going to be happy with a false gospel being preached. If you truly love sinners, you're not going to tolerate a false preacher teaching them. Why? Because to truly love someone means that you don't rejoice in iniquity, but you rejoice in the truth. Let's look at our third thought here under an explanation of love. It looks completely different than what you see on the soap operas, doesn't it? It looks completely different than what you see in the daytime talk shows, doesn't it? This doesn't resemble any of the Hollywood love I grew up seeing on TV. Charity, beginning in verse 7, is sustaining. It lasts. Look at verse 7 with me. Beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. I just wish I had a mom and dad that believed everything I told them. My life would have been a lot more fun growing up. The emphasis here is not on ignorance, but on a sustainable love. Remember when we said that true love doesn't, what was the wording here? True love was not easily provoked. It didn't go from love to hate, back and forth, back and forth. Here's why. Because love, biblical love, what Paul is telling the church at Corinth they should exhibit, here's why it doesn't do that. Because real love is sustainable. In order for a pastor to remain at a church long term, he has to have a sustainable love for that congregation. You know why? He's going to get mad at them from time to time. He's going to get fed up with a couple of them from time to time. He's going to wish they were all gone. He's going to find greener grass. He's going to get up on a Monday morning and go, I'm not doing this anymore. But how does he last? The only way he can last is if he truly loves his people, and that love requires a sustainability. That sustainability is right here in verse 7, beareth all things. That means it takes its fair share of the burden. Love is not passing everything off on someone else. Love is taking your responsibility along with it. Love beareth all things means it recognizes the burdens that other people bear. Love beareth all things means that there are things that will not break the bond of love. How does one keep such a positive outlook? Number one, he believeth all things. So he's just gullible. Ever tell somebody outlandish stories and they believe it? I used to do that to my mom and dad all the time. Make up stories, get them to believe it, and then go, hey, you believe that. That's not what's being implied here. Believeth all things means that it looks for the best in all things. It believes that people will repent. It believes that people will change. It believes that God is able to take the way things are and deal with them. And guess what? They may not change. But you believe that God is able to get you through these times of trouble. That's what it means to believe all things. No matter what your circumstance is, your faith is still in God, and you know that you're going to get through it in love. Hopeth in all things. true love does not focus on the negative aspects of the relationship. If you sit around and think about how bad your relationship is with the people you love, you'll be out of that relationship like that. If you sit around and think about how much you hate your job, here's where you'll end up, quitting. But what does it mean to hope all things? Or to be hoping in all things? To be hoping in all things means that you are expecting a change. You're not expecting this long term. You're hopeful for the future. Now, you need to have some realistic expectations. If you're frying fries at Brahms, you're not going to be president in the next election. But you can have some realistic hope. If you're in a relationship and it's not the way it should be, and you love that person, you need to maintain hope that the relationship will not stay this way. And you need to be doing your part to ensure that it's headed in the right direction. But a biblical form of love maintains a level of hope in the relationship where we're not sitting around glass half empty people all the time. That's not love. That's why the last phrase says, love endureth all things. You see, when you believe God's in control of all things, when you believe that God can change anything, when you believe that you love someone enough, you're not going to believe all the bad reports, you're not going to believe the gossip, you're going to give everybody the benefit of the doubt, you're going to do your own research, you're going to continue to believe the truth as best you know it, then guess what? You endure all things. Next thing you know, you look up, man, I've been in this relationship for years. Why? Because you didn't focus on the failures in that relationship. Because love is not focused on the bad things. Love is hopeful. Love is believing. Love is enduring. Love is sustaining. And when you continue to love someone and commit yourself to that person, or to commit yourself to that group of people, whether it be the church, if you maintain that relationship and believe God is able to do what He wants there and able to work, guess what? Next thing you know, you've been there a long time. That's the way love works. Love doesn't say, well, I'm going to sit here and grin and bear it and grit my teeth till it's over. That's not love. Love has a positive outlook on the future. That's the explanation of love. It's selfless, it's sincere, and it's sustaining. Now, let's look at verses 8 through 13, and let's look at the eternality of love. Love is eternal. Love will outlast every gift that these people wanted. If you look in verse 8, let's read through the end of the chapter. Charity never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child, and understood as a child, and thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know even as also I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, and charity, these three, but the greatest of these is charity. Now, the first thing I want us to look at is verse 8. Let's look at usefulness. Usefulness. Charity never faileth. Charity never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail, and whether there be tongues, they shall cease, and whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. You see, these things are only useful to us on the earth right now. But the earth as we know it, it's not going to be used in the way it's used now. Are we going to have factories in heaven where we go in and clock in for 8? Huh? I don't want to go there if we are. Are we going to have to go down and shop at the grocery store with Ron and pick up our groceries, plan out our list? But you know what we need now? We need these things so that we're able to function at the grocery store and at the factory. But Paul says, love is never going to fail. It's never going to end. But notice what will end. Prophecies. Truth-telling. Or future-telling. I think future-telling's already ended. But not because of these verses here. I just don't believe it's necessary today. Future-telling or preaching. I've heard preachers say, when I get to heaven, I hope God just let me preach the first 100 years. You're an idiot, bud. Nobody in heaven wants to hear your sermon. They're already there. They see him. They don't want to hear about him. They don't want to hear your rendition of what you think he is. He's there. Let me tell you about a guy back here behind me. I'm going to tell you all about him. No, thanks. I'll just go back there and be with him myself. I'm not going to be preaching in heaven. I heard a very famous preacher one time said, I hope God would give me my own planet and let me preach to it. Man. How did you get to the position you are in the ministry with that kind of mindset? Prophecies will fail. They shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. We won't need translators in heaven. We'll have it all to ourselves. We'll all speak the same language. We'll all know the same thing. I don't think you'll have to go to language school and learn to talk. I think you'll just pick it up when you get there. But there will be no more need for language because heaven is made up out of every kindred, tribe, tongue, and nation. And they shall be one nation, not in the United States. They shall be one kingdom under God. So, tongues are going to go away. I believe the gift of tongues has already gone away. I believe the need to learn other languages will go away. We won't need to learn other languages or have translators on that day. They will cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. The things you think you've learned now, you're going to get a whole new lesson when you get to heaven. I mean, I know some of these prophecy gurus, they think they have every hour of the 7 years of tribulation mapped out. They are going to be so shocked when it unfolds. I know preachers who think the Bible fits into 4 volumes of systematic theology and everything is locked together so tight you couldn't squeeze a paperclip in there. It's just, I mean, it's there. It has to be this way. You're going to get to heaven and have to throw away a lot of that knowledge. Because when you get to heaven, you're not going to keep studying. I've often heard preachers make this statement. I hope they have VHS movies in heaven so I can rewind them and watch world history. I'd like to rewind and see Moses really part the Red Sea instead of Charlton Heston on TV. That's just a curious mind thinking. I'd like to see that stuff too, but guess what? When I get there, I'm going to have all knowledge. You're not going to walk up and go, hi, I'm Harold Smith. I'm from Greenwood, Arkansas. You're going to look at that person and go, that's Abraham. That's Jacob. That's this guy. That's this guy. That's this guy. And even the unknown saints, you're going to look at them and know who they are. You're going to have all knowledge. And you're not going to go up to Jonah and say, Jonah, tell me how it was in the belly of the whale. Because those things are going to pale in comparison to being in the presence of Jesus Christ. All of those things are useful now. We need to study today. We need to be equipped today to communicate. We need to today to be able to proclaim the Word of God, to prophesy biblically. Those are not going to be useful in the future. Why? Because those things do not line up or match with love. Now, let's look at the understanding of our minds. you look in verses 9 through 12, Paul deals with our understanding. Verse 9, "For we know in part, and we prophesy in part." People who say that Paul talked to an angel and spoke angel language back in verse 1 of the chapter, well, in chapter 3, he said, "Though I have all knowledge and know all mysteries." Well, here he says, "I only know in part," so he does not have all knowledge. You know what that means? He did not speak angel either. Remember, he's saying, as if I had these things. Even if I had them, it wouldn't matter if I didn't have love. He said, "We know in part and we prophesy in part." I think my preaching is as accurate as possible. But you know what the problem is? It's me thinking that. And I don't know it all. And there's so much stuff I'm ignorant of. I like the other preacher told me one time. He said, "I know every preacher's wrong on something." And he said, "So therefore I know I'm wrong." He said, "But I just don't know what it is, and you can't convince me of it right now." And that's true. I'll argue with you on some stuff, and I may get there and find out I've been wrong on it, but right now I'm convinced of it. And a preacher ought to have some convictions. If he doesn't have any, he ought to quit. But convictions are necessary, but this is our understanding of current events now. This is going to change. Look at what he says in verse 10. "But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away with." All my life I was told what this verse meant. You know what it meant? When we got the written Bible, all the gifts went away. Prophecy, speaking in tongues, all these things went away. Healings, resurrections from the dead, all that stuff went away because the Bible's perfect. And they didn't have the Bible, and that's what it refers to. The only problem with that is it doesn't really fit the grand scheme of things. Paul is talking about these things ending when we get to heaven, not when we get a written word. So I don't think this is a good verse to make your case for that. What does it mean when it says, "But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away with"? It means when we all get to heaven, what a day of rejoicing that will be. When we all see Jesus, we'll sing and shout the victory. Now, on that day, the reason we can sing and shout the victory, the reason that we can have all this rejoicing, is because all of our questions are instantly answered. All of our needs are instantly met. All of our problems, done away with. Now we're free to do what we should be doing all along, worshiping Jesus Christ as God. So, this here, he says in verse 10, is not referring to when the Bible comes, but when we enter heaven. When we enter heaven, we will need those things. Paul then takes the illustration of a child. People say, "You talk about kids too much. You treat us like we're kids." Seems to me Paul liked the illustration of children too. I'm in good company. There again, I might be wrong about some things, but you can't convince me of them right now. "When I was a child, I spake as a child, understood as a child, and thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things." Paul said, when I was a kid, that's what I was capable of. On this earth, in human flesh, tainted by sin, this is what we're capable of, and this is all we're capable of. But when we grew up, we quit acting like a child. When we enter heaven, we will cease to act like a sin-stained human. And I'm glad about that. All right, we're talking about understanding. Look at verse 12. "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as I am known." The problem here is the word glass, because the Greek word is the Greek word for mirror. And in the 16th century, all mirrors were made of glass. In the first century, all mirrors were made of brass, metal, polished metal. Have you ever looked at yourself in a symbol? Have you ever looked at yourself in something where it was metal. And it wasn't, you could make out your face. You could see, I could see my mustache. And I could see my eyebrows. That's about it. That was the mirrors that they had then. So we're not looking through the bottom of a blue colored glass. We're looking in a first century metal mirror, and the translators say, oh, mirror. Yeah, glass mirror. And so that's how it says glass when it should say mirror. So Paul says, you know how you look in a mirror? And you can kind of see your face out, but you can't make it all, not the good details out. He says, that's the way it is now, but then, when we get the Bible? Remember, that's what some people think verse 9 means. Verse 10. No, verse 12 is not referring to when we get the Bible. It's referring to when we get to heaven. Then what? Then we'll know as we're known. We'll know everything about ourselves. We'll know everything about the people around us. We'll know everything that we need to know about God. Then, our understanding will be increased. So look at what's happened so far in verses 8 through 12. All this stuff that we needed is gone. Its usefulness is no more. Our understanding has been perfected so that we no longer need it. Well, what makes love so great? Love is endless, and it is still needed. Even in the perfected state, love is still there. Verse 13, love is unending. Unending. Look at verse 13. And now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three. But the greatest of these is charity. Right now, in the flesh, you and I, as sinners saved by grace, pilgrims from a faraway land, on a journey, looking for a city whose builder and maker is God. You and I have three things that abide with us: faith, hope, and love. Now, faith, without faith, it's impossible to please God. So therefore, we must have faith in order to be saved. Faith is the agent whereby grace is revealed in us. It is by faith we're saved. By grace that we're saved. And both of those are the gifts of God. So, we have faith and we need faith to believe in Jesus Christ as our perfect atonement and Savior from our sin. Hope. Why do we need hope? We need hope so that we continue in the faith. We need hope because our days are not always good. We need hope because we live in bad and desperate times. We need hope because every day's not in heaven. Every day's on the earth, and it gets bad and it gets worse, and perilous times shall come. But hope tells us that there's coming a day when we will put these things aside. It's that forward hope. It's the hope that's in love. That tells us this is not the way it's always going to be. That hope is what enables us to endure to the end. And charity. Without love, faith is useless and hope is useless. But Paul says the greatest of these is charity, love. Why is it the greatest? You're going to need hope in heaven. You're going to hope heaven gets better? Well, I hope heaven gets better. You'll never hear that in heaven. You don't need hope in heaven. Why? That's what you've hoped for. Are you going to need faith in heaven? No. He whom we believe in will be sitting on the throne. We'll be there with him. I go and prepare a place for you, that where I am, there you may be also. Faith is the evidence of things hoped for. The evidence of things not seen. Think about that. Well, hey, I saw him. There he is. I no longer need faith. Why? Because my faith has become sight. Well, what will I need? I still need the gift of love. Love endures all things. True love, biblical love, a love from God that's given to us and demonstrated for us in Christ is available to every believer. Oh, good. That means everybody will love me. No, 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 no. Love's not about you. You have the ability to love everyone else. I just don't feel like I'm very loved. That's not your problem. Your problem's to love everybody else. I just don't like the way things are. Hey, love's not about you. I don't know what I can do to change it. I do. You start loving people the way Paul describes it right here in 1 Corinthians 13, and people won't have a problem loving you back. But if you're going to do that, the goal ain't to be loved back. The goal is to love them.